I know that they're trying to compromise the election, so I don't want to go out there and throw names out there, but I'm going to say I think Donald Trump is behind it.
Postal workers in San Francisco protest to defend the U.S. Post Office and the upcoming election.
Almost 60 years ago, Dr. King spoke right here, but some people need to keep his name out of their mouth because they don't understand what he was talking about.
The 57th anniversary of the March on Washington was celebrated with a new march for the same goals, jobs and justice, while the 50th anniversary of the Chicano moratorium was celebrated in Los Angeles.
In fact, you can still see statements on TV even today saying, yes, you should stay at home.
And Michio Kaku on the latest coronavirus guidelines. From Pacifica Radio, this is COVID, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from the Pacifica Radio Network and its affiliate stations across the U.S. I'm your host, Ann Garrison. Now we'll hear highlights of the Republican convention held last week. Compliments of our colleagues from NowThisNews.com.
No one will be safe in Biden's America.
It's a horror film, really.
You won't be safe in Joe Biden's America.
Your family will not be safe.
They want to steal your liberty, your freedom.
Nightmares are becoming real.
Joe Biden is not a savior of America's soul. He will be the destroyer of American greatness.
He's a Trojan horse with Bernie, AOC, Pelosi, Black Lives Matter, and his party's entire left wing.
Joe Biden is basically the Loch Ness Monster of the swamp.
They will force the choice between being obedient to God or to Caesar, because the radical left's God is government power.
They will demolish the suburbs, confiscate your guns, and appoint justices who will wipe away your Second Amendment and other constitutional freedoms.
When I'm reelected, the best is yet to come.
Now, highlights from the Democratic convention held the week before last.
Just judge this president on the facts. 5 million Americans infected by COVID-19. More than 170,000 Americans have died.
Donald Trump's ignorance and incompetence have always been a danger to our country. COVID-19 was Trump's biggest test. He failed miserably.
President takes no responsibility, refuses to lead, blames others, cozies up to dictators, and fans the flames of hate and division.
There is no vaccine for racism.
Remember back in 2016 when Trump asked, "What do you have to lose?" Well, now we know. Our health care, our jobs, our loved ones, our leadership in the world, and even our post office. Don't forget, Joe and Kamala can win by 3 million votes and still lose. Take it from me. So we need numbers overwhelming so Trump can't sneak or steal his way to victory.
So I think we need to ask ourselves, why don't they want us to vote? Why is there so much effort to silence our voices?
This is a life-changing election. This will determine what America is going to look like for a long, long time. Character is on the ballot. Compassion is on the ballot. Decency, science, democracy, they're all on the ballot.
Donald Trump is destroying our country and everything we care about.
Tonight, I'm asking you to believe in Joe and Kamala's ability to lead this country out of these dark times and build it back better.
America needs a president right now.
And lastly, highlights from the founding convention of the People's Party, organized by the Movement for a People's Party, and held on Sunday, August 30.
Before we continue, let's acknowledge the previous owners of the sacred land that we're on. Goldman Sachs, of course.
Neither of the major parties in the United States represent the people. Both represent the interests of the wealthy.
I've been voting for this two-party system forever. For what? Why do we have them?
Right now, what we have is essentially a two-party duopoly that gives us one more choice than a dictatorship.
We can't have universal health care. Big Pharma won't allow it. We can't have a living wage. Big business won't allow it. we can't address the climate crisis. The fossil fuel industry won't allow it.
Politicians that we currently have in power and the system that currently oppresses us has been stealing our money for decades.
Can we thrive under this current system? Well, I would ask all of the people who are currently suffering due to COVID-19 who can't afford to pay their outrageous hospital bills.
See people in a pandemic who don't have health care. I don't know how anybody looks at that and says things are operating correctly.
Police haven't changed. There's no reforming the police.
If you provide the people with opportunity, there will be far less crime. The reason why people commit crime is because they see no other way.
We will always be voting for more war and more devastation so long as we vote Democrat or we vote Republican. It is time to vote for the people so that we can still have a country, a planet.
I have hope and belief in MPP.
The People's Party, they care about people.
We need a new party.
We need the People's Party now.
You know, in November, Americans are going to decide if they're going to vote for a right-wing, racist, pathological liar or Donald Trump.
On Friday, August 28, thousands converged on Washington, D.C. to protest for equality, jobs, and racial justice and against police brutality. We'll now hear from New York City public advocate Jumaane Williams, who addressed the crowd.
Everybody say, I'm not okay. Just the black folks in the crowd say, I'm not okay. I want to give space for everybody, but especially our black folks, to say that they are not okay. Because too often the trauma we have after seeing these videos, we're still required to go to work and pretend like nothing has happened. For too often, black women are scared to speak up because of white fragility and white tears. So I want to make sure I give the space for black folks to say they are not okay. Now, when I open the history books, I see throngs of people celebrating a tyrant, celebrating people who were trying to destroy entire communities by division. In Nazi Germany, I saw that. I'm not okay because the past 4 days in the Republican National Convention, I saw the same thing. We see people who are praising bigotry, who are praising division, who are praising this president who shouldn't be president, and I'm not okay with that. Almost 60 years ago, Dr. King spoke right here, but some people need to keep his name out of their mouth, because they don't understand what he was talking about. He talked about the dream, but he also talked about he was scared of a nightmare. This is the nightmare. 60 years ago, he was here talking about jobs and justice. I'm here with my stepdaughter, still talking about the same damn thing. We've only added more names to the death toll and more hashtags. But America is about bigotry. America is about those things, and it always has been. So we can't pretend like we have to say, we have to pretend that's not who America is. When they talk about law and order, when they talk about the American way of life, we've heard those things to defend slavery, to defend segregation, to put Japanese in internment camps. We've heard all those things to do the worst of us. But I tell you what, we are also America. We are the better America. We are the patriots. We are like Sophie Scholl and the White Rose in Germany. We are like Dr. King and Malcolm X. We are like the nameless grandmothers who got in the street and said, we will force America to be who she says she is. So be proud that you are here. Be proud you are in this time, because they are looking back at us from history, and our children are saying, do not forget about us. Remember us. Our job is to push forth a better society that we came from.
That was New York City public advocate Jumaane Williams at Friday's anniversary march on Washington. Thanks to our colleagues at nowthisnews.com for sharing that recording. This is Pacifica's COVID, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Ann Garrison. Also this week, Pacifica Radio WPFW in Washington, D.C., celebrated the lives of civil rights icons Representative John Lewis and Reverend C.T. Vivian as part of the 57th Anniversary March on Washington commemoration. WPFW News Director Askia Muhammad spoke to economist Jessica Gordon Nemhard about Lewis's less-known but critical economic justice work.
Most of what I know about John Lewis and the cooperative movement comes from his autobiography, Walking in the Wind. There's just a couple of short sections about it. And then I also recently read a piece by a well-known housing cooperator, David Thompson, who apparently had interviewed him about some of his co-op work and worked with him early on. But once he left SNCC and moved from voting rights into community organizing and economic development, that was so the late 60s, around 1967, 68, through the 70s and 80s, he was actually doing a lot of co-op development and promoting cooperatives among the Black community for a variety of organizations. But the major one was the Southern Regional Council's Community Organizing Project. He started working with them in 1967, and he talks a lot about how important it was to help African Americans to get control over their economic lives through cooperative economics. So credit unions, which are financial cooperatives, housing co-ops, especially agricultural co-ops, so people could stay on their farms, get food co-ops, and ways for Blacks to get jobs. One of my favorite quotes from him is about how important it was to move from just arguing for voting rights to arguing for economic justice and economic community control. Because he said, you know, after a certain time, we were able to vote, but we were still hungry, we were still poor, we didn't have homes, we didn't have ways to take care of our families. And so he went around his job as a community organizer, the director of the community organizing project, in the Southern Region Council's program. He said his job was to go around and talk to people in Alabama about how to pool their own resources to create credit unions so they could control access to money and financial services, to pool their resources to buy groceries or to buy feed and seed or tractors, or to work with their credit unions to get mortgages so they could buy their own land and farm for themselves. He grew up in a sharecropping family, so he understood very well the issues of debt peonage and poverty, that kind of thing. And he helped form Quilting Bees, women's quilting cooperatives, to help augment the income from sharecropping and other things. He worked with the early groups that started to promote the Federation of Southern Cooperatives. And then actually later in the 80s, 78 to 80s, he was working first with ACTION. He was appointed by President Carter, and there he also helped to form co-ops in the South. And in the 80s, he worked with the National Consumer Cooperative Bank, which is now called NCB. They hired him as a community relations director to talk about and to go around the country to promote co-ops among African Americans. So he actually turns out to be a co-op hero, even though most people have no idea about his economic justice side and all the economic cooperation, solidarity, economics work that he did in his career.
That's exactly what I was going to ask. We know of him at the Edmund Pettus Bridge and the effect that that had in the area of voting rights and civil rights, and certainly he's championed for that. But we don't think of John Lewis as having an economic agenda.
Right, but he absolutely did. And in fact, one of the largest Black co-ops in the South in the 60s and 70s was started by the same people who did the voter registration drive and the first Selma March for Freedom. So those same people. So first they were activated on the politics voting side. They used that collective energy and collective action to then form what was called the Southwest Alabama Farmers Cooperative Association. It within 2 or 3 years, it ended up having 1,800 families that were members of this cooperative, and it was the largest agricultural co-op in the South at that time. They also, the Southwest Alabama Cooperative also helped to found the Federation of Southern Cooperatives, which is a 53-year-old organization that promotes co-op development and support for Black land ownership throughout the South. And Lewis was actually the Federation of Southern Cooperatives' 50th anniversary keynote speaker in 2017. So even though most of his co-op work was in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, you know, just 3 years ago, he was still recognized as a co-op leader among the Black co-op groups. But I think some of the research I've done in my book called Collective Courage, A History of African-American Cooperative Economic Thought and Practice, I talk about in there how most of our leaders, especially in the 20th century, our civil rights leaders, were known for civil rights, voting rights activity, but also promoted and argued for the need for economic cooperation, economic justice, economic democracy, that it wasn't going to be enough just to get civil rights, just to be able to vote. We had to be able to attend to the other issues of life, and that economic cooperation was the best way for the whole race or the whole group of us to make progress. And John Lewis was definitely right in there. He and Fannie Lou Hamer were the two that kind of started out in voting rights, but ended with economic cooperation because they saw that just voting wasn't enough to increase the quality of life and to really address racial equality.
Economist Jessica Gordon Nemhard.
This is Steve Zeltzer from San Francisco. On August the 25th, demonstrations were held at post offices throughout the country to oppose the policies of Trump's national postmaster, Louis DeJoy, to destroy sorting machines, remove postal boxes, and limit overtime of postal workers, harming their efforts to get the mail out. They also said this would threaten the elections. Thousands of postal workers have been quarantined for possible contamination due to the pandemic. And in the midst of these attacks, privatization of the post office has escalated. Let's listen to their voices.
DeJoy, resign. Hands off. My vote is mine.
Privatizer's got to go. Hey, hey. Union busters got to go.
I'm Cindy DeTangel. I'm the American Postal Workers Union's SF local president. We're out here to, you know, get support from the community and get the word out there and be visible and let people know that we are fighting against all these changes that have been made to the Postal Service, and also for them to contact their senators to approve and get the funding that we need for the Postal Service survival. There's been several machines that's been dismantled in San Francisco, and there's still others that are just sitting there, not functioning at this point. I'm unsure as to whether they plan to bring them back, but as far as we know, they don't.
Why would they dismantle the machines?
Well, originally their excuse for that was that we had a decrease in the number of volume of mail that we're getting into San Francisco, which is true because of the virus. But I don't see the need to dismantle these machines, because once the virus has been addressed, once we have a vaccine, those machines still need to be there.
And you think that they want to affect the election?
Well, I'm hoping that once they straighten out and reverse all these changes, hopefully permanently, that, you know, we've always gotten the mail out. So there shouldn't be a reason why we can't.
We're here to raise awareness and let everybody know that what we have going on right now is crucial. They're trying to eliminate a lot of the crucial functions that we have going on with the Postal Service, a lot of the key elements that the community depends on us for, as far as delivering medicine, mail, important checks, important documents. All of that is compromised right now. And we got to stand up and let our voices be heard right now so that people understand exactly how crucial it is.
Who's behind this?
In my opinion, it's definitely coming from, it's a political standpoint. I know that we have a new Postmaster General who's getting rid of a lot of the machines that we need to do a lot of the work that we do. I know that they're trying to compromise the election, so I don't want to go out there and throw names out there, but I'm going to say I think Donald Trump is behind it.
How are you being affected?
Well, at work, my hours have been affected. We're not able to give the type of service that to the customers that they deserve and that they depend on us for. At work, a lot of people have been a little bit aggravated lately just because we're in a time where we don't necessarily know what's going on with everything with the virus and everything with our jobs. But for the most part, I think that we stay positive and we put one foot forward.
I'm Alice Lindstrom. I'm a retired postal worker and shop steward. And
currently still a representative of the San Francisco Labor Council from the San Francisco Local.
And what does this issue today mean for you and other workers, postal workers, and the public?
Well, this sign, which is an antique. I made this 50 years ago for the 1970 Wildcat postal strike. And the same issues are still here today. Better service. Even though there's less people coming to the post office because of coronavirus, there's still not enough people to serve them because 4,000 postal workers are in quarantine and 83 postal workers have died from coronavirus.
What do you think about privatization? You think they want to shut down or privatize the post office?
Back, starting with Reagan, they would bring troops of people through the post office, business people who would stand around insultingly and watch us and have open discussions about whether what we did was worth the wages we were paid. It was very insulting. And they want to privatize the post office by pieces. They want to privatize the more profitable parts and then leave the rural and the inner city parts to be done as a public service. So if the pattern holds true, which has happened in other countries where this happened, then the service gets reduced, like 3-day-a-week delivery and things like that in those areas, and then there's profit skimming in the richer areas. This has been a plan ever since Reagan, but it has accelerated on steroids. It's so much bigger now once Trump and his cronies got in.
Are you worried about a free election, democratic election?
I wasn't. In the most recent discussion that was had, President Dimenstein, our APW president, feels that we could handle the ballots like we always have. It's, you know, a little bit of overtime and everybody works hard and it happens. We've never had a problem in California before.
This is Pacifica Radio's COVID, Race, and Democracy. We'll be back after a short break. Stay with us. This is Pacifica's COVID Race and Democracy. I'm Ann Garrison. From Out FM in New York, we have an interview with longtime Black Panther Erica Huggins. She discusses her experiences as a Black Panther, including many months as a political prisoner, and the Panthers' public support for the then new lesbian and gay liberation movement.
I joined the Black Panther Party because when I read about it, the purpose was said to be to change the conditions of life for all poor and oppressed people. And growing up Black in Washington, D.C., I knew that that meant Black people as well as brown people, as well as indigenous people. And that touched my heart. That's why I wanted to join.
We're speaking with Erica Huggins, an educator, Black Panther Party member, former political prisoner, human rights advocate, and poet who's been lecturing for 45 years around the world on restorative practices and the role of spiritual practice in creating social change.
The original name of the Black Panther Party was the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense. Mm-hmm. And self-defense is misunderstood, but not by people of color. It's misunderstood because it means taking care of oneself and loved ones. And so the Breakfast for Children's program was self-defense. Mm. The People's Free Medical Clinics are self-defense. The end to mass incarceration is self-defense. And looking out for people when they're being arrested against the law is self-defense. Asking police officers why they're arresting someone who didn't seem to have done anything. And I witnessed this as a little girl in the neighborhood I lived in Southeast Washington, D.C., all the time. This wasn't just an adult understanding. This was something I'd seen all my life. I knew that self-defense was a proper response to violent behavior supported by violent structures. So here we are on January 17th, 1969, in the daytime on the UCLA campus. And before that, seven members of the Black Panther Party had been killed. So for me, it meant that I pulled out my black dress and went to a funeral. And because we worked 19-hour days, I had never had a chance to grieve. To know John was to be in the presence of lightheartedness and joy and just pure generosity. And to know Bunchy was to be in the presence of royalty, of openness. He taught many of us, having taught himself in prison, he taught many of us not only about African American history, but African history, which is never given to children in school. Never. And so he was a natural leader. Again, we were very young. The median age of members of the Black Panther Party was 19 years old. I was 18 when I joined. And on that day, John, who was 23, and our apprentice, Bunchy Carter, who was 26, were assassinated by the government. It changed my life forever. These were my dearest friends at the time. Bunchy was like a big brother. And John was my touchstone. He was my friend. He was also my comrade and the father of my daughter. So in that moment, I became a single mom and a widow. That's how it impacted me. And how did it impact the world? How did it impact the Carter family, the Huggins family, my daughter, Bunchy's son and daughter? It impacted us in exponential ways. And when those shots rang out and killed them, it became obvious that people had to look once again more carefully at the structures in place that allow for the value of Black lives, of lives of people of color, to be dismissed.
August 15th, 1970, Huey P. Newton, who was a co-founder and then became the defense minister of the Black Panther Party, who was heterosexual, gave a remarkable speech in New York City where he outlined the party's position on two movements that were then emerging, the Women's Liberation Movement and the Gay Liberation Movement. Now, until then, the Black Panther Party, while it had publicly opposed sexism, its leaders had never publicly spoken about the question of anti-gay oppression. Huey Newton's speech was later published and distributed widely by the party. And this, again, stood in contrast to the practices, the public positions of virtually every civil rights or Black liberation group at that time. And I just wanted to give listeners a little taste of what Huey Newton said, and then I'll ask our guest, Erica Huggins, to comment on it. He said, quote, "Whatever your personal opinions and your insecurities about homosexuality and the various liberation movements among homosexuals and women, we should try to unite with them in a revolutionary fashion. We must gain security in ourselves and therefore have respect and feelings for all oppressed people. I know through reading and through life experience and observations that homosexuals are not given freedom and liberty by anyone in the society. They might be the most oppressed people in the society. When we have revolutionary conferences, rallies, and demonstrations, there should be full participation of the gay liberation movement and the women's liberation movement. The terms, quote, faggot and, quote, punk should be deleted from our vocabulary. And especially, we should not attach names normally designed for homosexuals to men who are enemies of the people, such as Nixon or Mitchell, who, of course, was the attorney general under Nixon. Homosexuals are not enemies of the people. We should try to form a working coalition with the gay liberation and women's liberation groups," unquote. And again, that was Huey P. Newton, the defense minister of the Black Panther Party at the time. So Erica Huggins, as someone who was open about who you were, as someone who had relationships with both women and men from the beginning of your time in the Black Panther Party, can you talk about the significance of the speech, both how you felt about it when you first heard it, but also over time? That's almost 50 years ago. What you think it's kind of not only significance to the Black community, but really to the world was and is?
It has great significance because, you know, it reminds me of how happy I was when Kimberly Crenshaw created the term intersectionality. She didn't create it so that academic people can throw it around and use the latest word to describe something. She is in that body with coinciding identities, and so am I. None of us are just one identity. And so what Huey was speaking about was so important to me. That was 1970. I remember reading it because I couldn't see it or hear it while I was incarcerated. And it made me happy because he was talking about the hierarchy of oppressions in a way. And then I'm thinking, and he didn't say it exactly this way, but I've always thought about, excuse me, women of color who are in that spectrum some calls queer. Women of color who are also lesbian. Women of color who are lesbian and have children, like some of the women who were arrested and spent time in prison in New Jersey. So, but we don't think of that as, we don't think of the way that queer people have to defend their lives in the same way. as we do white women or black men who are heterosexual. So Huey was making a profound history-making set of statements. And he was also instructing party members how to behave, because it didn't go to the press first. Comrades got to hear this first. Mm. And I'm saying this because there was pushback from the white gay community in some part of New York about him saying this, because they thought he was doing something. I knew Huey really well. He wasn't doing anything but telling the truth, which he loved to do. And he was right. And I think that when I send people to that article, and I send people to it often, it's also in a book called The Huey P. Newton Reader. Mm-hmm. When I send people to it, they are amazed. They don't know about it. They haven't heard about it. Maybe it could be posted on the Out FM website. But at any rate, we have this notion that because we are black, no homophobia can be there. Or because we are gay, there can be no racism there. But that's fallacious thinking. That isn't how human beings are put together. We all have these coinciding identities, and some of us are socialized to believe in culture, which includes religion, that there are things that are abominable. So there is nothing abominable about a human being. So I was happy when I heard it. And I think it's still, that essay has great impact today. And I think that it should be part of women, gender, and queer studies on college campuses.
That was Erica Huggins speaking on Out FM, a weekly progressive LGBTQI news, culture, and activist hour broadcast from WBAI New York City. We thank John Riley, Bob Lederer, and the rest of the Out FM crew. This is Pacifica Radio's COVID, Race, and Democracy. We'll be back in a minute.
Soy chicano, señores, nací al lado americano. Para México soy pocho, no me aceptan mis hermanos. Los gringos me discriminan como si fuera extranjero, a pesar de que esta tierra fue de México primero. Este país es mi tierra, México es la de mis padres, pero la sangre que llevo es la de Benito Juárez. Yo soy purito chicano, de raza que no se raja. Mi madre nació en Sonora, mi padre fue de La Baja. Mis padres me inculcaron su cultura desde chavo. No es mi culpa haber nacido al otro lado del Bravo. Me da mucho sentimiento que en México no me quieran, porque a México lo quiero más que a mi tierra. Como Emiliano Zapata y también Francisco Villa, yo soy revolucionario en este moderno día. Unidos a César Chávez, los mexicoamericanos luchan luchamos por la justicia para todo el mexicano, por mi educación bilingüe, hablo chicano y gabacho. Ya se despide este pocho, hasta luego, y ahí los guachos.
This week was also marked by the 50th anniversary of the National Chicano Moratorium Against the War, in which 25,000 Chicanos marched through the streets of East Los Angeles to protest the high mortality rate of Chicano soldiers in the Vietnam War and the oppression and inequality at home. Now we'll hear from Frank Contreras, the Mexico correspondent, for Pacifica Radio KPFK's Pocho, Hour of Power, remembering journalist Ruben Salazar, an iconic figure for the Chicano liberation movement. Here's Frank.
From Los Angeles out to the rest of the world, this week we remember the life and death of journalist Ruben Salazar. He was killed in Los Angeles on August 29, 1970, during the protests of the Chicano moratorium. We remember him as a martyr who died when a police tear gas canister slammed into his head. Salazar was born on March 3, 1928, in the border city of Ciudad Juarez, Mexico. Just before his first birthday, his parents moved to the United States. He later graduated from high school and college in El Paso, Texas, and got his first job as a reporter at the El Paso Herald Post. He did well and eventually moved to California, working for newspapers in Santa Rosa and San Francisco. Ruben Salazar joined the Los Angeles Times in 1959. For many Mexican Americans, Chicanos, including me, Ruben Salazar is a hero and a role model. As a student, I looked up to him. Young people of color and many others who dream of becoming journalists still consider him a role model. He had a deep understanding of the U.S. civil rights movement and drew parallels with social movements for civil rights among U.S. Latinos. And he wrote with great passion and insights. Salazar broke a racial barrier in the world of news media by becoming the first Latino to work as a foreign correspondent for a major U.S. English language newspaper. As part of our tribute, I'm going to read an excerpt from the intro of a 1995 book called Ruben Salazar, Border Correspondent, Selected Writings from 1955 to 1970. This text was written by Mario T. Garcia. Foreign Correspondent, 1968. After 6 years of covering predominantly Mexican-American issues, Ruben Salazar was unexpectedly approached about becoming a foreign correspondent. While the Los Angeles Times was implementing its new policies by recruiting veteran foreign correspondents from other newspapers, it was also recruiting from the existing staff. This was necessary, according to foreign editor Bob Gibson, to avoid morale problems. Gibson's survey of the city staff reporters to assess potential recruits to the foreign staff brought Salazar to his attention. Gibson did not know Salazar personally, but he had been impressed by his balanced reporting on the Bracero program. He believed that Ruben Salazar possessed the characteristics of a good foreign correspondent. He was a good reporter. He was stable and reliable, and he demonstrated good judgment. Moreover, Gibson saw in Salazar a reporter he could use to expand the Times' coverage of Latin America. At the time, the only LA Times Latin America bureau was in Mexico City. In addition to establishing bureaus in Rio de Janeiro and Buenos Aires, Gibson hoped to increase the Times' coverage of Mexico, and it was there that Gibson expected to use Salazar. However, Gibson did not want to be accused of sending Salazar to Mexico only because he was a Mexican-American. Gibson's idea was to first allow Salazar to gain experience, or to cut his teeth, in Gibson's words, somewhere else. His plan was to expand the Times' coverage of the growing American military involvement in Vietnam by sending Salazar there as the paper's second reporter. Before Gibson could carry out his plan, the U.S. military intervention in the Dominican Republic occurred in April 1965. And on short notice, he borrowed Salazar from the City Bureau to cover this conflict before formally bringing him into the Foreign Bureau. City editor Bill Thomas recalls that Salazar was quite enthusiastic about this new opportunity. According to Thomas, this was natural for reporters who hated the idea of becoming stagnant. Quote, "Rubén was ambitious," Thomas notes, "so that becoming a foreign correspondent satisfied some of his ambitions." With his Mexican-American background and his ability to speak and understand Spanish, Salazar was a good choice to cover the Dominican Republic. Unwilling to tolerate what the Johnson administration considered to be a Marxist-supported military rebellion that threatened, in the new administration's view, to lead to another Cuban-style revolution, the United States all but destroyed the Alliance for Progress by resorting to an earlier traditional policy toward Latin America centered on military intervention. Over 20,000 Marines and other military personnel were sent to the Dominican Republic to install a government more acceptable to the United States. Salazar's reports from the island regrettably echoed the convenient arguments of the State Department that the United States had no choice but to intervene to protect American lives and to protect, quote, democracy on the Caribbean island. Salazar's uncritical reporting of the U.S. invasion, however, was balanced somewhat by an activist approach that at least provided a voice for the so-called rebels in his articles. Rather than wait around with his colleagues in the bar of an American-owned luxury hotel for U.S. official briefings, Salazar got into the streets in the capital, Santo Domingo, and into the provinces. He was thus able to humanize the insurgents, whose cause other journalists dismissed by simply referring to them as communists. Following his coverage of Santo Domingo, Salazar was approached by editor Gibson about going to Vietnam. Gibson recalls that Salazar was quite positive about this new assignment. He told Salazar that if he did well there, he might be put in charge of one of the other foreign bureaus. However, Gibson did not specifically mention Mexico City so as not to raise Salazar's expectations or cause a morale problem with his current bureau chief in Mexico. Salazar arrived in South Vietnam in the fall of 1965, as an American military intervention in that country accelerated. Salazar spent a year covering the military and political aspects of the war. Although many of his stories from Vietnam were on-the-scene accounts of particular military operations or political developments, again, Salazar occasionally allowed himself to participate in the events he was covering. While it appears that Salazar, like many other American journalists at this juncture of the war, supported U.S. involvement, in time he expressed in some of his own dispatches the misgivings as well as the excitement he felt in covering the war. In perhaps his most poignant story, published May 31, 1966, he wrote about the death of Private First Class Jimmy L. Williams, age 19, a young African-American soldier. When Williams's body was returned to his family in Wetumpka, Alabama, they were not permitted to bury him in the local all-white cemetery. He deserved to be buried any place, even in the White House grounds, one of Williams's friends told Salazar. That he was not permitted to be buried where his parents wanted him to be is going to bother me for a long time, that person said. Salazar concluded his piece on the politics of race in the Vietnam War by writing, quote, "Operation Hardihood, which started May 16th, continued Monday. Jimmy Williams's platoon has suffered heavy casualties. All of Williams's buddies killed with him were resting this Memorial Day where their survivors wanted them to be. All but Williams." According to Gibson, Salazar grew to oppose the war not necessarily for political reasons, but because of the tragedy and destruction of the war itself. He became more of a pacifist. Salazar's changing views about Vietnam paralleled those of the times, which went from wholehearted support of U.S. involvement to critical support and finally to complete opposition to it. In a 1970 interview, Rubén Salazar said of the war, quote, "It was a mistake that we were there."
That was Frank Contreras reporting for Pacifica Radio about the 50th anniversary of the Chicano Moratorium and the death of journalist Ruben Salazar at the hands of Los Angeles police on August 29, 1970.
This is Dr. Michio Kaku, professor of theoretical physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. You know, for months now, the government has been telling us, lockdown, stay at home. That's where you should be, at home. In fact, you can still see statements on TV even today saying, yes, you should stay at home. Well, scientists are now beginning to rethink that whole thing. Scientists now have thousands of data points as to where the clusters of the coronavirus originate. And they were shocked to find out where these clusters came from. At first, you might think, well, maybe they came from gigantic football games and huge frat parties with all the guys and girls having a great time without masks. Well, no, that did not turn out to be the number one cluster point. The number one source of coronavirus is your home. That's right, the very place where the government's been saying, stay at home for so many months. And now thinking about it, it's kind of obvious that it would be your home. First of all, think about it for a moment. 15% of all clusters come from your home. And why is your home the source of so much misery, death, and disease? Well, first of all, you're talking about your kids, your friends, your close relatives, one of whom may have the virus, one of whom does not obey masking, does not obey the 6 feet separation guidelines. One person can infect the entire household. Second of all, the household is indoors. Indoors, the virus circulates. You breathe basically reused air, air that could have the virus. And compared to outdoors, you're 20 times more vulnerable than someone outside. Next, what exactly is the mechanism that transports the virus into your body, perhaps causing you to die? Well, it's not eating utensils. It's not washcloths. No, it's none of the things that people originally thought. It's conversation. That's right. The intimate chatter that goes on at the dinner table, that's where the virus spreads, at home. Not at these gigantic parties that you see on TV all the time. Yes, they are dangerous. Yes, they shouldn't be partying like that. But that's not where most of the coronavirus clusters come from. It's close contact. It's breathing. It's coughing, sneezing, of course. But just in the presence of yelling, laughing, that could also trigger a cluster of the coronavirus. And of course, you're stuck in the house for hours at a time, breathing the same air. And so in other words, of course, for the most part, if you know that everyone is safe, then yeah, stay at home. That's where you should be. I was tested. I came out negative. You should get tested too. Because if there is someone in your household that's positive, they could be spreading the virus immediately to everyone, because that's where most of the clusters come from. They don't come from frat parties and sorority parties. They, of course, do contribute, but mostly it's people infected like mom and dad, grandpa and grandma, because their teenage kids run off and take off their masks and party too much. And so we're beginning to realize that some of the common sense attitudes and precautions that we took are actually wrong. Now, of course, the CDC is very conservative, takes time for new guidelines to come through. And these guidelines, of course, are for millions of people. So they have to be very precise and very cautious. But there is a new consensus developing among epidemiologists. The fact that airborne viruses, viruses on particles of droplets of water that are microscopic.
That was Dr. Michio Kaku, whose show, Exploration, airs on Pacifica Radio, WBAI in New York City. That concludes today's edition of COVID, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and its radio affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's show was produced by Polina Vasiliev and myself, Van Garrison. The show's executive producers are Akua Holt, Steve Seltzer, and Polina Vasiliev. Verna Avery-Brown is our executive consultant. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. Thanks for listening.